Thank you very much for coming, ladies and gentlemen. It's my honor to moderate this session. I'm Shariman from the Foreign Policy and Security Studies Program of ISIS Malaysia. Welcome to the ISIS International Affairs Forum on the United States and China in Southeast Asia, Power Shift or Competitive Coexistence. We are honored to have here with us Professor David Shambaugh. He is the Gaston Seeger, is that Seeger? Seeger. Professor of Asian Studies, Political Science and International Affairs, and the Director of the China Policy Program at George Washington University. He's also currently visiting Senior Fellow of the ISIS Yusof Ishak Institute in Singapore. He's writing a book there. Well, he's been with ISIS for about 6 weeks now, and he goes back to the US on Friday, so it's very, very kind of him to drop by at ISIS Malaysia. The bio is in front of you. Let me just say that no academic work on the rise of China or, you know, on the Communist Party of China is complete without references to Professor David Shambaugh's work. His presentation today, if I can just mention your IS article.
Oh, right.
Yeah, a lot of it is contained in this journal article, the most recent edition of International Security, and I would really, really highly encourage everyone to read this article. Ground rules. This presentation is on the record. However, during Q&A, we will apply the Chatham House rule. So Chatham House rule, there's only one rule that you can use the information that is mentioned views expressed, but you may not cite, you may not attribute them to anyone, okay? So we would like to have a frank, candid discussion, and Prof. Shambaugh is writing this very important book, and it would be very helpful if all of us can be very frank during the Q&A. So Prof, you will speak for half an hour, and Q&A after that. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Shariman, very much for the invitation, first of all, to visit ISIS here in KL. I have interacted with ISIS, I guess, almost since your origins, not quite all the way back to the mid-1980s, but I think from the late 1980s, in fact, when the late Norden Sopi was the director, who's a good friend of mine. But it's a pleasure to be here again, be back. In KL, my second visit in a year and second visit in my life, I must say. So I really like KL. I'll have to come back on an annual basis now. And thank you all very much for coming this morning. I was just looking over the guest list. It's a very distinguished audience, particularly from the diplomatic community here in Malaysia, but notable for lacking two participants, the Americans and the Chinese. I guess they're so busy competing with each other in Southeast Asia, they couldn't take time out to come to the lecture. Very interesting. I guess that's what big powers do. They don't need to be informed by others. They like to inform others. Anyway, that's just a curiosity. I'm sorry that neither the United States or People's Republic of China are here today, but a very distinguished group from all over the world, Brazil, Germany, Russia, Kazakhstan, Central Asia, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, a number of very distinguished diplomats. So thank you for taking the time from your busy days and your professional work to come today. So this topic, I have to say, is something of a new one for me in terms of my career. I've only turned to it in the last 2 years, year and a half, really. It's a work in progress. It's by no means, what I'm going to present you this morning are not finished findings yet. Some of my preliminary thoughts, on the other hand, I'm going to share with you, some of which are shared in this article in International Security that Sherman just mentioned. But I'm writing a book now called Where Great Powers Meet, America and China in Southeast Asia. So that book is in progress, as I say. It's about halfway finished, and should hopefully be finished by the end of this calendar year and published by Oxford University Press next year. So I'm still grappling with the subject and trying to educate myself. And I must say I'm using Malaysia as one of the case studies in the subject, because I think Malaysia and Thailand in some ways are the two swing states in this competition between the United States and China, particularly Thailand. But obviously Malaysia has been experiencing some experiences with China recently that we can talk about. So I'm China, as you know, I've worked on China most of my career and also the international relations of Asia, but I just want to premise my lecture today by saying I am by no means a Southeast Asia expert. I'm trying to remake myself, you might say, but it's a very complicated thing. This is a very diverse region. The first thing one learns, you learn two things quickly about Southeast Asia. ASEAN is an organization and not doesn't really represent in other ways the 10 member states, or it does represent the 10 member states, but for Americans, when we speak of Southeast Asia, we speak of ASEAN. Well, once you spend time out here, you realize that that organization based in Jakarta is an organization based in Jakarta, and that one really has to drill down into the 10 member states, and the second thing you quickly learn is the diversity of the 10 member states and their societies. And the third thing, therefore, you learn is it's impossible to generalize about Southeast Asia. Diversity is the rule. I'm not telling you all live and work here. This is not anything that should be a great revelation to you, but it makes scholarship and analysis of Southeast Asia exceedingly difficult because of the difficulties of generalization. But I'm trying to educate myself. So I'm going to give you sort of my interim progress report on what I've been learning. So here in Southeast Asia, of course, one doesn't find the geostrategic features of Northeast Asia. You have no massive armies, no large navies, no ballistic missiles, no potential flashpoints, at least on the order of North Korea, or former order, we hope, of North Korea, or even the Taiwan Straits. Yes, the South China Sea is a potential flashpoint, but I don't think it's of the same magnitude. Nor do you find the powerhouse industrial economies of China, Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan, all in Northeast Asia. But obviously, Southeast Asia is no backwater either. So I don't need to tell you why. You know this because you live and work here. So I'm going to let you just quickly digest these first couple slides. They're really meant for audiences that don't know much about Southeast Asia, trying to tell them why Southeast Asia matters. So, obviously, sixth largest economy in the world, excuse me, in aggregate, fastest growing region in the world, very rich and diverse cultures, religions, ethnicities, political systems, economies. And then there's ASEAN. And ASEAN, of course, is just entering its sixth decade, just enjoyed its 50th, is that the silver anniversary, I guess? Golden anniversary. And that's a significant accomplishment. I am an ASEAN admirer. In the United States, there are not that many ASEAN admirers, it has to be said. Many, and I think this is a real failing of the United States, including our diplomatic community, which does not, well, on the one hand, they tend to overemphasize ASEAN. They think ASEAN represents Southeast Asia, therefore all you need to do is go to Jakarta and talk to the Secretariat, get it done. Obviously, that's not the way ASEAN, despite the term ASEAN centrality, that's not the way ASEAN functions. So Americans, on the one hand, American diplomats tend to overemphasize ASEAN. On the other hand, they're excessively dismissive of ASEAN as a talk shop, an ineffectual organization that talks, plays a lot of golf, consensus-driven, never gets to decision, has weak, hollow communiques, if they can issue them at all, and doesn't implement their decisions. That's sort of the other side. And I'm saying I'm not endorsing that view. This is not my view, but I've heard this kind of perspective in Washington all too frequently. An overestimation and an underestimation, you might say, of ASEAN. But ASEAN has accomplished, I think, a great deal in 50 years in various means of integration, in keeping the peace, right? There has been no interstate war since the 1970s and the settlement of the Vietnam-Cambodia conflict. That's no small achievement. And strategic stability in the region has been enjoyed over that two-plus decade period. So I think ASEAN deserves a lot of credit. Okay, geostrategic significance. Again, you see these slides. I'm not going to talk through the slides. I'm going to expect or ask you if you're interested to look at the slides while I'm speaking. I'm not going to reiterate what's on the slides. Again, you know about the geostrategic significance of the Malacca Strait right out here, the various transnational security challenges across the region, the internal security challenges across the region, and the modestly rising defense spending across the region. There's a graph there that shows the increase, particularly in Indonesian defense spending. Vietnamese defense spending has also been going up. In fact, defense spending has been going up across the region, but very marginally, actually, and from a very low base, right? Southeast Asian militaries are not procuring large amounts of sophisticated fifth-generation equipment. So the region is important. It's also important for its own intrinsic merits, as I say, and it's important for geographic reasons, and it's important because both the Americans and the Chinese have been deeply involved in Southeast Asia for a long time. Obviously, the Chinese for much, much longer time. The maritime trade between China and Southeast Asia dates back centuries. The American engagement of Southeast Asia only dates back to the 19th century. 1818 is the date that we Americans tell ourselves it's when we signed our first amity of commerce and treaty of amity and commerce with Thailand, or the Kingdom of Siam at the time. So the Americans, relatively speaking, arrived much later. But the U.S. has been, as I'm going to argue this morning, deeply engaged in the region in the post-Second World War period as well. So for these reasons, Southeast Asia is an object of great power competition. That great power competition, I should hasten to say, in my view, is now global in nature. It extends to every continent on the planet, including Latin America. I've spent a fair amount of time actually in Latin America in the last few years looking at that issue and that competition. Africa, Europe, everywhere except Central Asia, by the way. That's because the Americans choose not to participate in Central Asia. But it's the U.S.-China competition is now, it's geographically comprehensive and it's functionally comprehensive. And it's becoming more and more acute. The trade war, or the early stages of the trade war, obviously now underway since last Friday. But you can look at every domain of the U.S.-China relationship: political, diplomatic, economic, strategic, ideological, cultural. The U.S. and China are locked into, I would argue, and most Americans would argue, indefinite competition. This is the new normal. Get used to it. Those who think that it's somehow going to revert to a more cooperative relationship, or as the Chinese like to say, a win-win relationship, forget it. That's not happening, at least from the American standpoint. And I think also from what I know about China, from the Chinese standpoint. I shouldn't be a surprise to anybody. If you've read Graham Allison's book, or you've studied the history of rising powers and established powers, we are to expect the situation that we get today. So therefore, this competition between the U.S. and China plays out across the planet, and it plays out in all those different functional areas. Southeast Asia is simply one region of that competition, but given its proximity to China and the American position in East Asia, broadly speaking, well, I should say the Indo-Pacific now is the term we appropriately use, Southeast Asia is the epicenter of U.S.-China competition. Okay, right here. And it's going to become more so over time. And therefore, Southeast Asian states and ASEAN as an organization, if you aren't already aware of this factor, you need to kind of wake up, because that's the big macro picture. A lot of stuff going on within the region, within individual countries, this country in particular right now, going through some very important transitions. Within ASEAN, yes, all that stuff that goes on internally and intra and across the 10 member states, true, but there's also this larger great power competition hovering over and interacting with the local issues. I should quickly say that it's not simply the U.S. and China that are playing roles in the region. So-called middle powers, Japan, India, Australia, and to some extent South Korea, are also significant actors. We will hear, in fact, on Friday, South Korean Prime Minister Moon is speaking at ISIS in Singapore. He's going to lay out South Korea's vision for the region. It's going to be, I'll be there. It'll be an interesting speech. So the point is that it's not just the U.S.-China great power competition. That competition is ameliorated by these other actors, so-called middle power actors. And indeed, each of the Southeast Asian countries are quite quick and keen to involve these other actors as a means of diluting the competition between the great powers. This is consistent with traditional Southeast Asian hedging strategies. Wherever Professor Quick is the father of hedging studies. When he finishes with his academic hedging studies, he's going to go into finance and really practice hedging behavior in the, on the stock markets. No, I'm teasing you. But I think anybody who studies hedging knows you want to diversify your bets. So if you're a Southeast Asian country, you don't just want to have a dual choice between the Americans and the Chinese, right? You want to have other options. That's where India comes in. That's where Japan comes in. That's where, as I say, perhaps South Korea comes in, and to some extent the Australians. So this is a very complicated picture. We have 10 regional individual actors. You have one organization, ASEAN, that makes 11. You have two great powers that makes 13. And then you have three or four middle powers. You're talking about 15 actors in one region. Not a simple subject to study. Okay. So as I travel throughout the region, I have encountered three pervasive regional narratives that are there on the screen for you to look at. First is that these hedging strategies of Southeast Asian countries are becoming increasingly difficult. And the pressure to choose, which is the term that is frequently used, between the Americans and the Chinese is increasing. So their traditional comfort zone of being able to navigate between the two big powers shrinking. And the first narrative suggests that they're increasingly having to make the choice. Second narrative one encounters frequently throughout the region, I did last year when I spent 6 months in Singapore at RSIS, and I went to 9 out of the 10 ASEAN countries. Everywhere I went, I encountered the second narrative. The United States is undependable, distracted elsewhere, has no strategy, and simply does not attach significant strategic significance to Southeast Asia. The Obama pivot policy, while well-intended, didn't deliver. TPP pullout, and uncertainty over Trump's approach to the Indo-Pacific. That's the second narrative. The Americans can't be relied upon. Third narrative, that China, on the other hand, has become, not is becoming, has become accomplished fact, the regional power. And all countries are gravitating and should gravitate into China's orbit. The China train has left the station. All Southeast Asian countries need to get on the train. Don't be left behind. China has the money. China has the presence. China has the proximity. China has the strategy. So that's the third narrative I encountered going around the region, this gravitation. So I'm not endorsing any of the three narratives. In some way, all three are correct. But they're not really correct. Well, they have elements that are persuasive, but if you look at those narratives empirically, I find a great disconnect between the narrative and the reality. The narratives are, well, first, perceptions matter in international relations. Perceptions become realities. They become objective realities. They have their own kind of momentum, even if they are not reflected in empirical facts. I find that those narratives are only partially true. China is on an offensive in Southeast Asia, no doubt about it, and in South Asia, and for that matter, globally. Central Europe, from the Baltics to the Balkans, Latin America, Africa, Central Asia. This is a massive global expansion by China. Its toolbox, primarily economic, but has other elements in it too. Diplomatic, increasing amounts of security assistance to some states, and so-called soft power, cultural power. So China is on the offensive. The United States, for its part, is guilty of distraction and what I call episodic engagement. Means, you know, periodic engagement. But what I really find is that the narrative about China in Southeast Asia is vastly overstated, and the appreciation of the American role in the region is vastly underappreciated and understated. If you look across a number of indicators, the United States does more than holding its own. I would argue, and I would argue if I were not an American, that comprehensive American power substantially exceeds that of China in Southeast Asia. Now, many of you out there say, what is he talking about? Because you all have this notion about China. Well, walk through it. We can walk through it in a minute. The different categories: diplomatic, commercial, security, cultural. Four categories. But before we get to the four categories, I don't know if you can see this spectrum. It comes back to the earlier point I made about the inability to generalize about Southeast Asia. Because of the diversity. So all 10 countries have different degrees of relationship closeness with China and with the United States. This slide that you are looking at is my rendering of the spectrum of closeness or less closeness to China pre-election, during Najib. Obviously, Malaysia, which I have in lumped together with Thailand, as I say, I describe both of these countries as aligned accommodationist, right? That's before the election. Malaysia was definitely aligned, was accommodating China, and was aligning, that's a strategic term, towards China. So I call them and the Thais aligned accommodationists. Obviously, we're in a very fluid period right now. I would like to hear from you as to where you think the new Mahathir government is going to take Malaysia's China policy. Which directions is it going to go? I think we all probably assume it's going to become less close to China, but we need to talk about that. Is he only interested in renegotiating the terms of the One Belt, One Road deals for financial reasons? Or is there a greater geostrategic calculus behind the pause or the suspension of these projects? Is there a deeper rethinking? I'm posing a question to all of you because I would like to know. Is there a deeper rethinking about China going on here in Malaysia? And what does that reflect? Anyway, you can see, I don't want to take too much time on this, you know, Cambodia is at one end of the spectrum. I find Myanmar and Laos just inside of Cambodia. I call them chafers. Cambodia I describe as a capitulationist. It is sold out. It is a client state of the People's Republic of China, almost the 32nd province of the People's Republic of China. Myanmar and Laos are in similar positions, but they don't like it. They just don't have an alternative. The Americans aren't giving them an alternative. The Japanese aren't giving them an alternative. The middle powers, so on and so forth. So I call them chafers. They're chafing under China's control. Then I have the two aligned accommodationists. Then I have two countries I call the tilters. They're tilting towards China, Philippines, Brunei. Then I have two countries I call the balanced hedgers, Vietnam and Singapore, both of which you might think are the two countries closest to the Americans in Southeast Asia. Well, not so, really. If you look at the depth of both of those countries' relationships with China, you find a lot of activity going on, a lot of exchanges and a lot of investment and even military exchanges. And then you have out at the far end of the spectrum what I call the outlier, Indonesia. Indonesia is the outlier, more to do with Indonesia than with anything else. It's just a very insular, internally consumed, massive country who, you know, doesn't really think much about geopolitics. And so that's my spectrum. Just for the interest of time, let me quickly go through the dimensions of American and Chinese ties to the region and tell you why I come to the conclusion that the depth and breadth of the American presence in the region is deeper and broader than the Chinese. So again, four categories: commercial, cultural, diplomatic, military, security. Commercial, the United States does, in terms of trade and trade only, the United States does not match China. American trade is $261 billion in 2016. 261. That's a quarter of a trillion dollars. The Chinese are about 480, I believe. We'll get to that in a second. So not quite twice, but significant. However, other than trade, FDI, the American stock of FDI far, far, far exceeds China. The American stock of FDI in the region, $226 billion. The Chinese, about 115, roughly half. American stock is greater than China, Japan, and South Korea combined in the region. And annual FDI, which you would think would be dominated by China, not so. Last year, American FDI, $13.5 billion. Chinese, 11.5. That's 2017 figures. So the Americans are still investing on an annual basis more in the region than China. Now, asterisk, caveat, Hong Kong. We don't know how to calculate the figures of pass-through money from the PRC through Hong Kong into the region. That's a significant factor. And then if you look at the American companies throughout the region, there are 4,200 American companies registered in Southeast Asia. And they span the spectrum of different sectors. But it's interesting to look at what they do concentrate in. Basically two things: defense industries and civilian aircraft. That's one category. So Lockheed Martin, Boeing, the other big multinationals that work in that space, doing very well here. Boeing has sold 75 aircraft in Southeast Asia alone in the last 12 months. Not bad. I'm sure Airbus is envious. The other category, though, of American commercial footprint, services. Financial services in particular, but consulting services, standards, and other things. So the Americans are operating in a more high-end spectrum of trade and investment, whereas the Chinese, as we'll get to in a second, are operating in a low-end. Energy extraction and infrastructure construction. That's it. That's what the Chinese do. They sell some products as well. Americans also sell products. So it's an apples and oranges comparison. It's important because we're in different industries. The American economy is frankly more sophisticated than the Chinese economy, and it's reflected in the types of FDI in the region and what the Chinese are doing here. Public diplomacy, I think one of America's great strengths all over the world. Again, there are a bunch of examples there on the slide. Soft power, public diplomacy is something governments do. Soft power is something societies do. You add those two categories together, the American footprint, if you will, in this area, very substantial, including the Young Southeast Asia Leader Program, YSEALI, that President Obama initiated. Diplomatic engagement. Here's where I think the Americans really have a weakness, actually. It's what I call parachute diplomacy. They fly in, they give us a reassuring speech about the American interest and the depth of American ties, and they fly out. And a number of months pass until they fly back in and do it again. Chinese are here all the time. Well, maybe they are, maybe they're not. Why aren't they here today? I don't know, why aren't the Americans here today? Good question. So, you know, it's a long way, that's part of it. Tyranny of distance. For an American official to fly from Washington, D.C. to the region for an East Asia summit, piggybacked onto an APEC summit, piggybacked onto a U.S.-ASEAN leaders meeting, piggybacked onto a bilateral state visit, it's like, first of all, that's 5 days of in the region. And it takes you basically, you know, even on Air Force One, a day in each direction. That's just a long way to come for American leaders. So I would say the diplomatic engagement, though, is maybe the weak point, but it's not insignificant either. And then finally, the real strength of the American footprint in Southeast Asia, security. I shouldn't say every country. 7 of the 10 countries in the region are quite happily dependent on the United States are engaged collaboratively with the United States in a range of military and defense relationships. They buy their weapons from the United States. They train their officers and their troops by the United States. They engage in all kinds of joint exercises with the United States and professional military education with the United States and intelligence collaboration. The U.S., this is not known. You know, regional governments, including the one here in Malaysia, doesn't like this to be known. They don't talk about this publicly. The Star cannot publish an article about the depth of U.S.-Malaysian defense relations, right? It will never, at least under the previous government, it would never happen. So regional governments don't like to talk about the American security relationship because of one reason, China. Another reason, their own domestic populations. But I can tell you, it is the backbone of the American presence in the region. Now, what about China on the same comparative? Let me try and wrap this up. If you look through these four categories, China, I would say, is more diplomatically active in the region than the United States, both bilaterally and multilaterally. I visited the Chinese mission to ASEAN in Jakarta about 2 weeks ago. They're very active. Americans are active, but not as active as the Chinese are. Bilaterally, you go around from one country to the next in Southeast Asia, all have very active diplomatic relationships with China. Some with the Americans, some do, some don't. So as I say, the diplomatic space is the area where I see China actually having an advantage. Culturally, yeah, there's a slide of all the Chinese different cultural affairs exchange programs. There's not a lot of there, in my view. Students, yes, there are now something like 3,000 Southeast Asian students, I believe. 3,600 is the number that comes to mind. Southeast Asian students studying in Chinese universities. You know how many Southeast Asian students are studying in American universities last year? 55,000, okay? So, sure, you want to go get, and I'm noticing a number of Southeast Asian students are beginning to go to Chinese universities for their PhDs. Fudan, I got an email last night from young person in Thailand just graduating from Fudan. So a lot less expensive. But are you going to get the same kind of education in a Chinese university you're going to get in the United States? I doubt it. Maybe that's a condescending thing to say. I shouldn't say that. But so the cultural space, the Chinese are trying to expand that. They're spending a lot of money on it worldwide. This is part of their whole soft power initiative, or now what's being described in the West as influence operations. Very interesting. Big subject, big in Australia, in New Zealand, in the United States, in Canada, in Western Europe, Chinese influence operations. I've been in the region for 6 weeks, haven't heard one person talk about Chinese influence operations in Southeast Asia. Like, it's either a given. In fact, I've had a couple people when I've asked them, they say, well, of course it's going on. We just accept it, you know. So influence operations are distinct from, very different from, soft power cultural affairs operations. There's some overlap in some areas, media. But anyway, the Chinese cultural footprint outside of the ethnic Chinese diaspora communities, they're very strong inside the Chinese diaspora communities. And every Southeast Asian country obviously has a large Chinese diaspora community. But outside that community, not very strong, and in fact, quite suspicious, I have found. Commercially, you know the subject, you know the statistics. As I say, a total trade, $514 billion now, shooting for $1 trillion. The goal, the joint ASEAN-China goal is $1 trillion by 2020. That's going to be impossible to reach, but nonetheless, it's expanding dramatically. It's facilitated by the China-ASEAN FTA, which has now either been upgraded or about to be upgraded. So China's footprint, trade footprint, very large. Its FDI footprint, growing. But as I say, primarily in energy extraction, raw material extraction, and infrastructure construction. Increasingly in IT, yes, Huawei, Xiaomi. You come in from the airport, you know, here in KL, you see all these Huawei signs. I think Huawei has laid the broadband for Malaysia. You may want to revisit that decision. And of course, the Maritime Silk Road, OBOR, One Belt, One Road, or the Belt and Road Initiative. You're quite familiar with that. Southeast Asia is the, in fact, last year when I was here in Malaysia, someone, I won't mention who, described Malaysia as ground zero of OBOR. Well, that was under Najib, and it was ground zero. There were, nearly 30 OBOR projects going on in your country. They're obviously under review. Some are suspended. Some may be killed. So I don't know if it'll continue to be ground zero, but obviously not just Malaysia, but the entire Southeast and South Asian region, pretty fundamental to China's Belt and Road ambitions. We're going to have to wait, I think, 5 years to see how this Belt and Road thing plays out. It's too early to say. Much of it is literally undergoing land reclamation. Things have not been built yet. So we're going to have to wait and see. But the early indicators are that this is not going to be smooth sailing. Debt trap problems, big problem. Just go ask Sri Lanka. If you need some evidence. But there are other such cases. Quality of the infrastructure. Terms of the deals. Labor percentages. What percentage of Chinese labor versus local labor? There's all kinds of questions that are being asked. And this is still early days. So my guess is that we're going to have some successes and some failures and some pushback, quite a lot of pushback, I think, against Belt and Road, and even pushback within China. There is a debate inside of China. It's mainly amongst intellectuals, but others too, even in the commercial community, about the viability of this. One argument is, if you're not going to make money out of this, why go there? If these aren't profitable projects, why do it? That's one argument. Second argument is overextension, strategic overextension. This is an argument made by some professors, names I won't mention, but Anyway, within China, there is growing questioning of Belt and Road. So we're going to have to wait and see how that goes. Defense cooperation, last category. China has some with Malaysia, has some with every Southeast Asian state, actually. Arms sales, $2.6 billion to the region. Americans are somewhere, I think, around $28 or $30 billion a year. Cambodia, Myanmar, Thailand, Malaysia, the four greatest recipients of Chinese weapons. Joint training, everybody does it, just not on a scale that they do it with the Americans. Ship visits and defense minister meetings, and next year you're going to have, or maybe even later this year, there will be the first ASEAN-China joint exercise, naval exercise. Dates have not yet been set. So in conclusion, I'm sorry to run on longer. It's okay? Well, let me just try and bring this together. Both powers, U.S. and China, possess influence. And influence is really the greatest definition of power, according to most social sciences, is whether you can get another party to do something that you want them to do or not do something that you want them to do. That's the definition of power. Power is not just an objective factor. That's called capabilities power. That is one type of power, but you have to convert capabilities towards desired ends, right? That's kind of social science 101. And both countries have power and influence, capabilities, and America's greatest strengths, I would argue, are in its hard and soft power, its forward naval presence, its deep military assistance programs across the region, neither of which the Chinese come anywhere near matching, and American soft power appeal, which, again, I don't think the Chinese come close to matching. In American media, movies, sports, higher education, technology, so on, even aid programs, this may surprise you, the United States spends four times more ODA than does China in Southeast Asia. I repeat, 4 to 1. And Cambodia gets 80% of China's ODA. So I know that's just one of those little statistics that, you know, Southeast Asian governments decide not to publicize. In fact, the EU contributes, I believe, 3 to 1 more ODA to the region than does China. So next time the Chinese are talking to you about investing, why don't you ask them for a little ODA first? So the American strengths, hard and soft power. American weaknesses, distance, tyranny of distance, long way away. Secondly, the American emphasis on democracy, human rights, and good governance, which are not bad things to emphasize, but they don't go down well with authoritarian Southeast Asian regimes. Now, under Trump, that emphasis has disappeared, but nonetheless, over time, it's been a, you might call it an inhibiting factor for the U.S. Third weakness for the U.S., as I mentioned, is Washington's impatience with the so-called ASEAN way of diplomacy, its obsession with consensus building, and its failure to find unity in the face of China's growing presence and pressure, including in the South China Sea. Fourth weakness of the Americans, a lack of government funds to match China in investment and infrastructure projects. And last weakness, as I say, is a long-standing one. It's the episodic diplomatic engagement. You know, start and stop, start and stop. The Obama administration was the exception to the rule, and I think Southeast Asian countries actually got used to it, got used to the attention and the prioritization that they were receiving 8 years under Obama. But we're now reverting to the pre-Obama pattern of episodic engagement. So Trump last year, between May and November 2017, paid a lot of attention. From January to May, zero attention. May to November, quite a lot of attention. 4 Southeast Asian leaders visited the White House. All 10 ASEAN foreign ministers visited Washington. Trump himself came out here, of course, in the autumn. Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State. So there was a real uptick between May and November of 2017, and then since November, here we are now in July, nothing. So this, we're reverting to the same pattern, I would argue, under Trump that we saw pre-Obama. So Obama, exception to the rule, but something to be aspired to. That's the way the Americans ought to behave in Southeast Asia, prioritization and constant attention. China's strengths, what are they? Geographic proximity and money. Geographic proximity and money. And no political pressure concerning human rights and governance, no conditionality. China's weaknesses for, vis-a-vis Southeast Asia, ironically, geographic proximity. It's too close, it's too overbearing. It's always here, you know, and it's just sort of, they won't let up, is the perception that I hear as I go around the region. Second weakness for China, the South China Sea, and the militarization of the South China Sea. That's not viewed well in the region. Third weakness, China's occasional, not frequent, but occasional diplomatic manipulation of ASEAN. It happens behind the scenes, behind closed doors, but you can see the manifestations of it. ASEAN doesn't, can't produce a communique at some of its summits. They water down the language to the, even if the communique is issued, or it doesn't have any real substance. No mention of China. Oh no. No, they have a complete veto power, the Chinese do, over ASEAN when it comes to diplomatic language. And that's influence. That's influence. Negative influence, I would argue. But anyway, they increasingly manipulate the agenda, or they try to manipulate the agenda of ASEAN and leverage their bilateral relationships. Another weakness, no real ability to provide security and defense for the region, I would argue. And lastly, historical suspicions that Beijing is using ethnic Chinese communities as fifth columns here in Southeast Asian societies. You'll recall the incident with the previous Chinese ambassador here in KL last year. That's just one indicator of a Chinese change towards the diaspora communities across. So both countries have strengths, both powers, I should say, have strengths and weaknesses. When I look at it, though, and I try and draw up a kind of balance sheet, I, in fact, find the Americans to have a broader and, in most categories, deeper footprint. And just to come back to finish on the point I started with, there's this great disparity between the narrative in the region and the empirical reality. The narrative's all about China. China, 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 China. But the reality of it is the Americans are not insignificant players and partners in these categories. And therefore, I would encourage our ASEAN friends to say so publicly more often. I'll stop on that point. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Prof. Already people are indicating that you, let me just reiterate that this is now on Chatham House rule. There was on record before this, Chatham House rule now. Before you ask your question, please identify yourself and be brief. But quick, before I get to you, can I just, you know, take advantage of this being the moderator? Prof, I just want to test this assumption I've always had. And that assumption is that, well, the U.S. commercial presence, cultural engagement, all that, the volume, you know, if you, as you've demonstrated, it's much larger. But China is able to calibrate it to, you know, maybe the flow isn't that great, but they're able to shape the flow to serve foreign policy objectives. Mm. Example, mm. Huawei, they can maybe tell Huawei, go there. President Trump, even if he was in the mood to do so, he can't tell GE to go to Malaysia. Yeah. Even not only just commercial presence, maybe even like, you know, you mentioned the VOA. Well, no one actually can tell VOA how to do their reporting. Well, that's my assumption. You know, but China can tell CCTV or Xinhua, okay, this is how you want to shape the narrative. Right. So, you know, does that give China a certain advantage? But before you answer that question, can we collect some others before, or would you like to address this one first?
Why don't I address that one, and then we can collect maybe two or three in groups, and I can respond to those. So I think you're absolutely, I'm going to ask you to borrow a piece of paper. No, just thank you very much. I think you're absolutely right. The role of the Chinese state is definitely an advantage for them. And the role of the private sector for the Americans is definitely an advantage. You know, what the U.S. does in the region commercially, even in the education space, and in the media space, and that whole broad soft power space, it's all American society and private sector actors that are doing this. Yes, there are some Chinese private sector companies operating in Southeast Asia, but as you suggest, and they're not all SOEs. Yes, there's a lot of SOEs involved, particularly in BRI projects, but in the culture space, as you just mentioned, and certainly in the other two spheres, diplomacy and defense, those two spheres, both governments are deeply involved, of course. So that does give China, in the commercial space, which I guess is your question, an advantage. It can direct its investment. But I don't know if that is an advantage, you know. It targets it, and China fills those spheres. But as I tried to argue, the commercial competition is an apples and oranges competition. It's not really fair to even measure the statistics against each other. You have to measure the sectors in which the two countries are investing. And if you did pie charts, I've seen pie charts, I should have one for the presentation, of the American commercial footprint, it's very diverse. Nothing exceeds like 15%. Whereas the Chinese is about 50% extractive industries, 35% infrastructure, and 15% other. You know, it's really very different. I'm not trying to say one's better than the other. They're just different. But this Chinese state, yeah, sure, they can target loans, they can target their investment, they can target their cultural exchanges. They have money. They just throw money everywhere. Throw money at scholarships, throw money everywhere. And that's what the Americans used to do at the height of their empire. That's what great power empires do. That's what imperial countries do. But you have to be more sophisticated, I would argue, in the way you use the financial instrument and how you try and get return on your investment, you might say. So in the cultural space, I would say China's not getting a whole lot of return on their soft power investment. They spend somewhere between $12 and $20 billion a year worldwide on this broad space, soft power public diplomacy, what the Chinese call duiwai xuanquan gongzuo, external propaganda work. Is their soft power, you know, dramatically increasing around the world? No, not around the world. Certain pockets of the world, Central Asia, that's about it, actually. Africa, it's going down. Latin America has begun to come down. If you look at the Pew polls, favorability ratings have plateaued and, in fact, begun to decline in parts of the developing world. I don't know about Southeast Asia. There hasn't been some good polling done here in Southeast Asia. It really needs to be done. I'm going to talk to your former colleague Tan at ICES about doing some of this. We need to get a better sense in ASEAN of, and not just favorability ratings, a more sophisticated, granular sense of perceptions of China, and for that matter, the Americans too, and Japan and India. So I don't know, that's how I'd respond.